KZSU, Stanford University. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. When you listen to this show, actually, I will be a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society and an assistant professor at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. But as we're recording the show on June 5th, I can accurately call myself a resident fellow at the Center for Internet Society. Hearsay Culture is a show that focuses heavily on technology and law. And today I have the opportunity to focus more on the law side, but also on technology with someone who is a real luminary in the world of public interest litigation, and more broadly, a public interest lawyering generally. I'm very excited to have on from Stanford, Alan Morrison, who among many accolades worked at the Public Citizen Litigation Group, which was founded by Ralph Nader, for more than 30 years. And pretty much any of the public interest litigation that Public Citizen ran, from consumer advocacy to open government, Alan had a hand in, and he remains a very active public interest lawyer. And we're going to talk about those projects, but also I want to get into a discussion with Alan broadly about public interest lawyering today. You know, as a lawyer and someone who practiced before entering academia, I've always been very interested in the motivations behind people entering these worlds and how we can encourage more people to do this kind of work in the face of financial and other pressures that exist, because alas, public interest lawyering is not the most lucrative from a financial perspective endeavor that one can embark upon getting a JD. But with Alan Morrison today, who I'm very excited to have on, we have a guest who can talk very authoritatively about not only his experience as a public interest lawyer and his experience generally in the profession, but also is able to take a more perspective look on where we're headed. In addition, another topic that we're going to be discussing today, which is a topic that I've covered with a number of guests on Hearsay Culture, from Al Roberts from Syracuse, who wrote Blacked Out, to Steve Aftergood from the Federation of American Scientists, who does a secrecy project, is government secrecy and government openness. And one of the areas a Public Citizen really was at the forefront of handling were Freedom of Information Law requests and Freedom of Information Act litigation. And government secrecy, again, remains a major issue, not only from a technology standpoint, of course, but generally in society, given the security culture that we live in, certainly post 9/11. And again, with Alan, we have someone who can speak both to the history and to the future of where we're headed on issues involving government secrecy. So we're going to have a pretty broad and wide-ranging discussion today with one of the giants in the field. I'm really thrilled that Alan took the time out of his extremely busy schedule to join us today on the show. And so I will thank Alan again when we start the conversation after a short music break here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. An awkward fade-out, but of course, this is not a music show, as much as I love music. I'm very excited to have on the other side of the glass Alan Morrison. Alan, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule today to join us on Hearsay Culture.
It's my pleasure, Dave.
I think many listeners, but perhaps not all, will be familiar with Public Citizen and your work, but for those that aren't familiar or newer to this profession, perhaps your background and the background of Public Citizen as a general overview would be a good place to start.
Well, Public Citizen was started by Ralph Nader in 1971, and he approached me through a mutual friend about coming and setting up the litigation group in the fall of 1972. Fall of 1971, and I actually started in early 1972, came to Washington from New York, where I had been working. Public Citizen was one of the first broad-based public interest groups. It did litigation when I got there, but it also had a health group, it had a lobbying group, it did tax reform and other things as well. And Ralph raised most of the money from direct mail solicitation, advertisements in newspapers, didn't rely on foundations, as did many of the other public interest groups when it started. So we always had a broad base, we've gone forward from there, and the organization's been in business now for over 35 years.
And when it started out, I mean, you were there really at the beginning of the organization. Fast forwarding to today, how has it grown? I mean, how big is it today as you look at it?
Well, there are about 100 people working for Public Citizen today. And, you know, when an organization gets started, it gets to the point where you don't have any accountants and you don't have any receptionists, you don't have anything else, you don't have a personnel officer or anything like that. And you have to have support people because you just can't – everybody can't do everything themselves. So the organization has grown in a lot of ways and has a budget, I think, now of $12 or $13 million. You can go online and see the tax returns, which are public. Available www.citizen.org if you're really a masochist about those things and you can understand them.
Right. Yeah, that's the other challenge. The we could spend the whole show talking about the many cases that you litigated through Public Citizen over the intervening 30 plus years. But given that this is a show that focuses a lot on technology, I think consumer advocacy, of course, is an area that both Ralph Nader and Public Citizen became well known for. I guess the broad question I want to ask you up front is consumer advocacy from the time that Public Citizen started versus today. We can see consumers using technologies in different ways. Obviously, the ability of people to connect between themselves and with the government and with the commercial sector is far greater than it was 30 plus years ago. Taking a retrospective view, where do you think consumer advocacy litigation along the lines of what Public Citizen did, and I encourage you to give a brief background of that as well, where are we today in 2007 versus when you started endeavoring in this area?
Well, I was thinking about this and talking to some other people the other day about this, and I remembered that we had a big fight, a number of big fights with the airline industry about various practices. And we tried to disclose what the airlines were doing about lost baggage and overbooking and things like that. And so our aviation-related group went out to wanted to go out to National Airport over Thanksgiving at a time of great stress for baggage and missed flights and pass out literature. And the FAA, which controlled the airport, wouldn't let us do it. They didn't like what we were saying. And so we had to go to court. We got an injunction. Of course, the judge said the First Amendment, and we weren't blocking anybody's passage or anything like that. And so we were able to do it. That was in about 1974, I would say. Fast forward to about 2001, and I got a letter, or maybe it was an email. I don't remember because a lot of the stuff comes over the transit that way. That's how we get some of our cases, but no means all. Notice I'm still saying we, even though I'm no longer a Public Citizen.
Right.
Because
right.
I still work with them. In fact, was on the phone with them this morning and tomorrow about some other things. Anyhow, a letter comes in from a woman here in California who had a very bad experience with termites. She had a termite inspection done by Terminex. And Terminex promised her that there were no termites, and sure enough, there were termites, and they wouldn't pay on the policy, so she sued them. Unfortunately for her, her expert witness failed to show in court, and they threw her out of court the day there was a trial. She was proceeding pro se. And so she started a website, which, of course, she couldn't have done in 1973.
Right.
And she started dumping on Terminex about how unfair they were. So they sued her for libel. And she got it. She defended that on a slap suit here in California and got attorney's fees against her. And she kept up her website. So the next thing happened was they brought an action for trademark infringement against her for using the trademark name Terminex. And they brought this action against them in their headquarters in Memphis, Tennessee.
Wow.
And she gets this complaint, the trademark in Tennessee, federal court. She has no idea what to do, so she just sent us a letter. And as soon as I saw it, I said, this is a new area. It's an old theme, but a new area. And so we offered her help, and we got a little help from a trademark lawyer because we had never done anything like that. But we also knew that there were serious First Amendment issues, which we had done plenty of. And also knew that they had no business suing her millions of miles, thousands of miles from her home. Anyway, so we filed these big papers, and then we did the second thing, something that we've often done in the past. We went to the newspapers, and this time to the Wall Street Journal, and it was on the front page of the second section of the Wall Street Journal, I think on a Friday, and by early the following week, the case was withdrawn. And so,
which sounds like it was a good move on the part.
But this got us started on doing all these cases. We had a case, interestingly, involving the airlines. And a man was going to a wedding in India on Alitalia, and he bought all these special clothes for the wedding, and the baggage didn't get there. And he had allowed a couple extra days, and the baggage didn't get there, never got there. And Alitalia told him that he could – the only claims that he had were something like $750 for the value of a couple of clothes. And he wasn't a lawyer, and he didn't sue them. So he started a website called Alitalia Sucks. And Alitalia sued him for trademark infringement.
There you go.
Confusion, consumer confusion.
Oh, there we go. Yeah, all right.
And these are typical of these cases which are being brought to silence consumers. No real chance of success on the merits if anyone with a law degree was on the other side. But they knew that most of the people wouldn't be able to defend themselves. They'd get an injunction, or they wouldn't even need to do that. They'd say to them, all right, you don't have to pay us our lawyer's fees if you'll take down the website.
Right, right.
And so that's what's happened. So this was a whole new area, and we began doing it in about 2001, I guess. And the group still does it in a variety of different contexts.
The issues of free speech, of course, run throughout much, if not all, of the litigation that Public Citizen has been involved with. And obviously, you know, it's nothing profound that the internet has changed the way that people communicate. Do you see the consumer issues that you talked about in these cases involve intellectual property rights, at least in part, and involve free speech? And you know, intellectual property rights, you know, I know intellectual property law is not something you focus on heavily, but intellectual property law is an area that, I focus on and that I work on at CIS, and indeed it's an area that has become far more prominent today than it was 30 years ago. Where do you see, in terms of public interest litigation, where do you see intellectual property rights type cases, especially cases where you're talking about chilling and chilling effects of these kinds of threats? And there are, you know, chillingeffects.org and other websites that focus on simply the deterrent effect of cease and desist letters by way of one example. Where do you see intellectual property right litigation in the broad panoply of public interest litigation occurring today?
Well, I think in the trademark area, it's going to be largely defensive. That is, people, big companies in particular, are going to be using trademark to stamp out criticism. And I expect that to continue because the economics are all that way. And unless somebody starts enacting laws that make it very punitive to bring a wrongful trademark case, they're going to continue to be brought. Second, for some time, I have been very concerned about and have not really done what I probably should have tried to do about the patent system. Most of these patent lawsuits are two giants fighting over who's going to get the money, and the people who are losing out are the people down in the trenches who are going to pay the money, and the question is only to whom is the money going to be paid. And the patent system is set up in a way that there's no adversariness over at the patent office, there's no consumer or public interest of any kind. And I think that one of the things that's going to have to happen is we're going to have to find some way to get better balance into the patent process at the front end and perhaps along the way, so that arguments are made about the invalidity of patents that would knock out both sides instead of just transferring it from one to the other. And I don't quite know how to do that because it's a big step and it's a big change, but in a way it's kind of the way that litigation group and other consumer groups fought over economic issues, which these really are, although they're in the form of patents.
Right.
When we were fighting about the airline rates and the telephone rates and all those kind of things, we had to find some way to get into the process at the front end because we were getting trampled on at the rear end.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be a big challenge in the intellectual property area, to find some way to make the patent system, which everybody who's sensible agrees has to stay. We have to have some patent system. The question is, has it gone too far? I'm involved in a case now with Mark Limley here at Stanford involving the patenting of a second generation of seeds. Soybeans reproduce, and when they reproduce soybeans, they reproduce seeds. And Monsanto has claimed a patent in it, and the Federal Circuit has recently upheld their claim to the patent in the second generation of seeds, even though God has created the seeds and not Monsanto.
Right.
And so, you know, that's something that's going to have to go on. And those, of course, were things that were technologically impossible 30 or probably even 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be sure that our laws adapt to that.
You mentioned using the press in litigation, and that's also an, something which I want to talk about. Again, for obvious reasons, blogs and podcasts like you know, Hearsay Culture, which becomes a podcast after being on the air, are, again, new ways that people communicate. How do you use blogs and podcasts in the context, if you do, in the context of public interest litigation and broadly? You know, again, I'm using crystal ball questions here up front, but how do you see those technologies changing the role of the public interest lawyer, if at all?
Well, I confess not to be much of a blogger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably too long in the tooth and been around too long to do that. And I actually find that if I start doing that kind of stuff, I'll never get off. And, and I have too many other things that I really need to do.
Well, that ties you to all bloggers, though.
Yeah, well, except a lot of them don't get off.
Right, that's right.
And if I could only figure out a way to put down on over the internet the thoughts that really mattered as opposed to the ones that didn't, I would be better off.
A different kind of law, yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, we're going to have – it's going to be a lot easier to get your opinions out and your views out. And the question of what strategy you're going to use to get the public aware of your kind of issues is certainly going to be different from what it has been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the use of websites by organizations to making their work product readily available to everybody has surely changed things around. And I really don't know how that's all going to play out. The mainstream press is still significant. You can't do without the television networks and the main press organs.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other things as well, and particularly for the younger generation, they don't read the newspapers.
Yeah.
They don't read magazines, and they don't watch much television news to the extent that there is any news on television as opposed to other things that pass for entertainment with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it's one of those areas, I think, where when we talk about how people consume information, we're talking ultimately about a question of what media culture we live in and what the media, the traditional media, can do to deal with it. Which begs the question, which is not for you, but more for theoreticians on the media, which is whether traditional media has a future in this model. But from a public interest lawyer's perspective, I guess, notwithstanding the fact that you don't blog, the technology exists and is there. And when we look at something, an area that you and I have discussed off-air with voting machines, we look at an example of litigation that's come out of the issues involving the accuracy of voting machines that was largely driven initially by activists who had websites, as you mentioned. And I guess the question is, for an organization like Public Citizen that's been around for a long time, that in many ways really, you know, wrote the book, to use an older phrase, on public interest litigation, how do you view the activist-oriented technology that exists today that allows for, you know, websites like Black Box Voting and others to ultimately themselves initiate litigation? Where is an organization like Public Citizen and other public interest lawyers in that model?
Well, I don't have a very good answer, which is probably a good reason, a good justification for why I'm no longer a Public Citizen, that there comes a time when us old folks need to move on.
Uh-huh.
And the younger generation, which is not simply familiar with, but at home with these kind of technologies,
yeah,
thinks actively,
uh-huh,
figuring out how we can use them. There's no question that information is there and it's available. The question really is, how do we get it out in a form that people can not simply access it if they want to, but are it's made available to them without at the same time inundating them.
Mm-hmm.
I can't read everything that comes across my email every day.
Right.
And I fear that that's the problem. And then people who are saying, well, I spent part of today browsing around the web, that's just not part of my regular culture.
Right. Yeah, you know, and it's one of those things, I think, where the ways that people, again, that consume the information change so radically. But in a lot of ways, I think the kinds of ultimate decisions that you have to make as a reader of news really are no different than they've always been in terms of assessing the veracity and the accuracy of what you read. Let's talk about another area that you focused heavily on, and it's an area of mutual interest, which is government secrecy. And again, you know, when Public Citizen was beginning its work, FOIA was a new act, in fact. Again, looking back from where we are today, how has government secrecy in terms of its let's start with the government's ability to keep a secret. Where do you see the changes having entered into? And indeed, while I recognize that you don't focus on technology heavily, how do you see from your experience technology impacting the ability of the government to keep a secret?
Well, I think it's much harder to keep secrets. If somebody is determined, in two respects, if somebody's determined to get something out, all they got to do is press a button, put an attachment on an email or send the email out to somebody or everybody, and it's impossible to stop it. Maybe some government agencies have outgoing blocks on their email system, but it's not like checking your documents when you walked out of the building at night.
Right.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, it's harder to destroy documents than it used to be.
Yeah.
Aside from the fact that there are all kinds of levels of things being saved, when you delete, it doesn't really quite mean delete. It's also harder because the ability to search electronically for words will find things that you couldn't have found before. There was a story in the mid to late 90s when Noriega was being prosecuted by the government. And he claimed that the White House had done all sorts of nefarious things. And the court said, well, I want you to search the White House for documents on this. And they were able to perform a search in a matter of a few days that they could literally never have done if this was not electronically.
Right.
And, of course, electronic, there are copies of everything around, and you have no idea, can't always tell who got copies of everything or who they were forwarded to.
Right.
And so it's harder to lose documents. It's harder to figure out what's happening. I mean, just take what's going on with Attorney General Gonzalez now and all these meetings that didn't happen. People weren't there. Turns out that there were all kinds of things. And when you, if you're a lawyer in that situation, you're trying to figure out what happened so that you can, take stock of the situation. These documents keep showing up in very inconvenient places,
right,
and will continue to show up in inconvenient places because that's the way the electronic systems work. And of course, you can see much more in them, who got them, what changes were made, all sorts of other things that you could never see on a paper record. So, in many respects, it's going to be harder to destroy documents. It's harder to not be able to find them. And in that sense, it is a different world. And of course, when a new administration comes in, all those things are there.
Well, yeah, that kind of leads me into the real next question, because FOIA, when it passed, certainly, you know, the legislative history, at least as I understand it, is that it wasn't something widely endorsed. It wasn't something that the government suddenly decided, hey, this is great, let's open everything up.
Oh, no, quite the opposite.
Yeah.
I mean, there was never a law that prevented, except for a few circumstances, documents from being made public.
Right.
They just weren't made public, and they weren't made public because there was no law that required them.
Mm-hmm.
As I often say, no bureaucrat ever got a promotion or won a medal for disclosing documents. Quite the opposite.
Yeah, and you know, there's a study that I read. I guess it was part of the legislative basis for the law that I think the University of Michigan Law Review, right, was a massive hundreds of page study that I remember thumbing through for research I was doing. But the nutshell was, and the question I want to ask, is that FOIA in its original conception was designed to allow for this veil to be lifted and for information, you know, a very wide range of amount of information to be made public. And now, of course, we know, again, fast forwarding, that there are numerous exceptions to FOIA, some of which are massive loopholes, trade secrets being one, national security being another, in addition to other laws separate from exemptions to FOIA that carve out massive ways for the government to keep information that the law initially intended to be made public secret. litigation in that context, where do you see public interest litigation with respect to freedom of information requests litigation going? What are the hot topics that you see today?
Well, let me first disagree with you slightly,
okay.
Which is I think everybody knew that those exemptions were there.
Okay.
They weren't loopholes in the sense that somebody didn't realize they were there.
Uh-huh.
Nobody had fully thought out how broad they would be or
fair
how
enough.
They were going to be carried out. But everybody knew they were there. Indeed, they were necessary policy choices. And in my judgment, nobody thinks that there should be no national security exemption or no exemption for trade secrets or law enforcement. The question is how broadly should they be construed?
Uh-huh.
And on that, the courts have been generally not as good as I think they should have been.
Uh-huh.
They have given too much deference to business on trade secrets and to the government on national security. But the ability to bring a lawsuit and make the government explain is incredibly important because it forces them to give up at least many more documents than they would do otherwise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And even if the court doesn't order very many documents disclosed, and they never do in the national security area, documents still get disclosed because the government's embarrassed. They can't explain why they've given up document A and document B refers to A, and why can't they give up document A and B as well. And so I think that the FOIA has been terribly important and will continue to be so. We've seen what they've the ACLU and others have done about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and lots of things that are going on in the war on terror. And if you don't control the Congress, you don't control the White House, the only thing you've got is FOIA.
And on that note, let's take a short music break. I want to come back and discuss a little bit more about government secrecy and then go into your recent book and talk about public interest lawyering generally. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU. My guest today is Stanford Professor Alan Morrison from previously of Public Citizen. So when we come back from a short music break, we will continue the conversation with Alan Morrison. Party with a very dark vision of the world that we live in, which is contrary to the topic of today's discussion. Before we continue the conversation with Alan Morrison, now's the time on the show where I ask you for money. And it's not money for me, I point out every so often, it's money for KZSU. KZSU is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station here at Stanford that requires donations from listeners in order to maintain its wide-ranging programming. If you're interested in making a donation, or at least thinking about it, you can go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the webpage for KZSU, and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. But regardless of whether you give a donation or not, I do hope you keep listening to the show. So we're back with Alan Morrison. And Alan, before the break, we talked a little bit about the world of secrecy, and I guess a follow-up question to where we're headed is the culture itself. Do you think the technology that exists today changes in any way the motivations of the government with respect to keeping secrets? In other words, is there today we see this conflict, of course, in the security culture of more information being kept secret, and indeed there have been studies done recently to show that in terms of sheer numbers that there's more information that's being marked as in one way or another ineligible for public dissemination, and yet we have this thrust, this push for people to get information by way of this technology. Where is the tension, and where do you think we are?
Well, I think the principal reason we have more secrecy is because this is a very secretive administration. They basically take the view that we'll decide what you need to know, and it's none of your business unless we tell it your business.
Mm-hmm.
And that arises from the fact that the people at the head of the administration came out of corporations where that's what they did and there was no law to the contrary, or they came out of parts of the government like the Defense Department where that's been the rule, and they've applied it across the board.
Mm-hmm.
They make no secret about their secretive motives. And the problem is that it's just wrong, and it's inconsistent with our laws. The real difficulty is that even if the courts were much more aggressive,
mm-hmm,
and willing to overrule these secrecy claims, there just isn't enough time in the day and enough people to bring lawsuits to prevent them. The inertia is all in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they understand that. They're not dumb people. And they know that it if they get hit a few times, it doesn't matter because their ultimate goal is to keep things as secret as possible.
So it's almost, it's really a cost benefit analysis. This is the price for making the decisions that need to be made in your view.
Well, I think that's a charitable way of putting it. They just don't want anybody looking over their shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think most of us are in a way like that too. Mm-hmm. But they don't understand, certainly not accept, the public benefit in having an open society.
Which leads to a rather theoretical question, but I think an important one, which is, you know, the Benthamite view of governments and the ability of the public to view the world boils down to the public has a right to know, but more importantly, the government benefits from the public input. And if you fast forward to people like Ely who've written about the humiliating effect of disclosure, that literally people will be shamed into doing the right thing. We have all of these theories that drive from the standpoint of improving government. And I guess the overarching theoretical question I have here on as far as government secrecy goes is, do you think transparency and FOIA in particular have been successful in improving the operations of government? In other words, I'm not asking you whether you think transparency is a good thing. I mean, I think we both agree that it is. I don't think that's too controversial. It's pretty boring radio if I asked you that question. But more specifically, how successful is FOIA been as a vehicle towards that?
Well, it reminds me of my favorite question in life is, as compared to what?
Yeah, right.
So
right.
As compared to what life would be without it, it's definitely better.
Right.
As compared to what life could be with a better FOIA and a better court system, not as good.
Right.
Has it shamed some people? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Has the knowledge that documents could be made public prevented people from doing things they shouldn't have done? I hope so, but it's hard to prove.
Yeah, yeah. Is there any particular area in FOIA that you think is rife for reform right now? I mean, if you were to say, here's the one area, what would it be in your estimation?
My own view is that there ought to be some kind of a time limit, mm-hmm. strictly enforced on all of these documents.
You mean in terms of their classification?
Classification, yeah. and other things, not just classification, that is trade secrets.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine a trade secret still being a trade secret after 10 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just maybe the formula for Coca-Cola, mm-hmm. and maybe you could have some special circumstances, something like that, but I don't think the government's got the formula for Coca-Cola, so I'm not really worried about it.
Right.
You know, time is a great antidote to all these things, and among other things, if these documents had to be made public after a certain period of time,
mm-hmm.
You would see how overblown the claims were way back then even.
Yeah.
We have an interesting experiment. The FOIA has an exemption for internal agency memorandum, so that if you write your boss a memo saying, I think we should do this about such and such and so, it can't be made public, mm-hmm. Unless the boss decides he wants it public, which is almost never the case. There is a statute called the Presidential Records Act, which applies to the records kept by the White House, which are not subject to FOIA.
Mm-hmm.
And in that statute, at the end of a period of 12 years after the end of administration, which could be as long as almost 20 years from the time that the documents were created, all internal agency memorandum or internal White House memorandum are not kept secret.
Hmm.
They're made public. And so we're learning a great deal about the White House. And if there was ever a place where it made sense to have people speak their mind candidly,
right.
so that they weren't inhibited, it's surely in the White House.
Right.
And we're discovering that the sun comes up in the morning and the moon and stars still rotate around the universe. And all of these terrible things that we were told going to happen at the end of 12, 15, 18 years, guess what? They don't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's always seemed to me to be significant. And if we started by, in the national security area, mandatory declassification, you know, there are still some documents revolving the breaking of the Japanese code in World War II that are still classified.
Now,
somebody has to explain that to me. What do you think they're doing over there now?
Right, and the technology, I think, has advanced a little bit since the early 40s. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah, it is remarkable.
But it's the knee-jerk, reflexive reaction that we never let these things go. Griffin Bell, who was the Attorney General under Jimmy Carter, put out a memo in which he said, when you get a FOIA request, the first question is, not, is there some exemption we can rely on, but is there some real good public policy reason why this document shouldn't be made public? Mm-hmm. If the answer to that question is no, we're going to release it, even if we could do it the other way. As soon as he got out of office, they flipped it around, and it stayed flipped ever since, essentially.
Yeah, and that's, and you know, this is, I think, at least from having people like Al Roberts from Syracuse and Steve Aftergood on, it seems to be where we are at this point, that there is the presumption against.
Absolutely.
It's one of those things where I guess, well, I'll ask you the final question as far as secrecy goes before we turn to our last topic for today. But do you see a change coming? I mean, aside from, I mean, the political aspect of it being what it is, but even putting aside a change in administration, we're in a culture that's so heavily focused right now on national security, perhaps for good reason, but focused on security. And we also identify the keeping of secrets and the non-disclosure of information as being in our security interest. When that's more debatable. Where do you think we're headed? I mean, do you see, I mean, putting aside a regime change, right, use the word regime, maybe that was a bit of a slip.
How about an election?
Election, let's put it that way. An election in the United States, where do you see the culture headed?
I don't see the Congress having enough votes to do anything about it. I don't think the bureaucrats will do things on their own, and the administration will keep the lid on. If we get an election with a new administration that's less wedded to secrecy, we might see some changes. But it's a culture that's been there for a long time, mm-hmm. and all the incentives are in favor of secrecy. And so it's going to take a lot of push. Somebody in the White House and in the agencies would have to make it a priority and be willing to give up other things in exchange for this.
Right.
Maybe it'll happen if for no reason to embarrass the current administration if the new administration comes in.
Which is often a motivation for policy changes, and sometimes it works for the better. Well, moving on from regimes, that was a good slip on my part for a radio show. Let's turn in a final segment of the show to talk about your new book. The top level question, of course, is the title and what is its core theme?
It's called Beyond the Big Law Firm, Profiles of Lawyers Who Want Something More. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could say it was my book in the sense that I wrote the whole thing. Oh, maybe I wouldn't have wanted to spend the time writing, but it's actually most of the work is done by Stanford law students here and with my co-editor, Diane Chin, who was the director of our public interest program here at Stanford at the time. The book is designed to fill a major void that most law students and lawyers know about the big law firms. They know about them because they show up on campus. They're very large. There's lots of stories about them. They pay lots of money. And many of our students come here and even leave here not really wanting to go to big firm but not knowing what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so for close to 25 years, I've had this idea and never, until I came to Stanford a few years ago, never had figured out a way to get it done. And the way we got it done was we identified lawyers around the country and identified law students who would go out and interview them and profile them.
Hmm.
And so we have lawyers from, I think, 15 different jurisdictions around the country, 19 different law schools or 30-some-odd lawyers in all, doing a variety of civil criminal work outside the traditional big law firm.
Hmm.
Some of them work for very small law firms. We have a solo practitioner, people working in small law firms, people doing immigration work, labor work, people working for universities, working for governmental agencies, people doing criminal work, civil work, litigation, non-litigation, matrimonial, employment discrimination, a whole cross-section of extraordinarily interesting people. I know because I read these profiles at least two or three times each. And the people are interesting, and the students really got into it, and they are interesting. And each profile is different. They are similar in that we tried to have a kind of a set of questions and a format, but nobody said you had to start at the beginning and he was born on July 14th, 1938 or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
The profile people are all about 10 or 15 years out of law school, so they're reasonably far along in their careers, but not so far along that the students and the recent graduates can't relate to them.
Yeah, right.
And many of them have worked for large law firms, although by no means all of them. And the unifying fact about all of them is that they're very happy in their work.
Hmm.
Every one of them gets up in the morning and goes to work and enjoys it.
Yeah.
And that's not true of a lot of lawyers around the country. And moreover, they feel like they're contributing usefully to society. They are not making as much money as they could make in other places, but it doesn't seem to bother them. Mm-hmm. They've found ways to make ends meet and decided which of their ends, financial and personal, are more important.
Yeah.
And the book is available on Amazon. It's in bookstores around the country beyond the big law firm. Morrison and Chin are the co-editors. And I'm very pleased with it. It has a quite dramatic cover, which we can't show on the radio.
Yes, one of the limitations.
I think it's going to be it's worth reading. Not everybody will relate to all the people.
Yeah.
But that's hardly surprising because we are all different. And what we're trying to do is to give you an exposure to the range of opportunities that are out there so that if you say, I don't like what I'm doing now, we say, okay, how about one of these 30 other opportunities?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's, you know, someone who, you know, was an associate at a law firm for a number of years. You know, I have firsthand experience of the pros and cons of private practice. And, you know, to me, first of all, I think there's a dire need for books like this because people don't realize the opportunities that they have. And I think, unless you think it through carefully, you miss some of the real, unexpected benefits of public interest lawyering. So a book like this is quite useful. But I guess I want to ask you the question in terms of, you know, it's a sad state of affairs, I think, because I think you're right that there are a lot of lawyers who are not satisfied in the work that they do. And there's a firm culture that exists, which fails in a lot of ways in terms of one's personal motivations for becoming a lawyer in the first place. Where do you think the legal profession is in terms of its recognition of these kinds of severe and significant dissatisfactions with practicing law from a large segment of the lawyer community?
Well, I think that a lot of the attitude is, well, if you don't like it, you don't have to come to work for us or you don't have to stay.
Yeah.
We're providing a service, which they are, and we're providing people very good salaries, which they do. And that's the bargain. Some mm-hmm. may say Faustian, others may say not. I don't see much in the way of motivation to change that, in part because these law firms are so enormous now. You've got 500, 750, 2,000, 3,000 lawyers in a firm.
Yeah.
It's like trying to turn around the battleship. When I started practice, I was in private practice in New York for a couple years before I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office there. I worked for what was then a big law firm in New York. We had 55 lawyers. That's a boutique now.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And
a business model that's difficult to exist in this market.
Yeah. What we look to see is a law firm that's maybe that size or even smaller mm-hmm. saying collectively, we're going to lead a different life.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make less money, a lot more than most people in the United States will make,
right.
but less than the big firms will make. And we're going to live lives that we want to live. We're going to take on cases that we want to take on, whether they pay us or not.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to tell the clients that don't just call us on Friday afternoon and tell us you need something done unless it really needs to be done.
Yeah.
Because we're not, you go to someplace else because we're not going to just stop everything that we're doing just to service you. And it takes a gutsy group of people to do that, and they have to collectively agree that they're going to have a different model, and we're going to be time off for family. There's going to be sabbaticals. There's going to be parental leave
yeah.
and part-time work. And people are going to have to make a collective decision to lead a different kind of life. And so far, I don't see any firms that are doing that. Some do it a little bit at the periphery, but not yet. And it'll take a very gutsy firm to do that. My own view is that they will be able to attract very good lawyers who want something different from the big firm, even if they don't, lawyers are not ready to go into a nonprofit organization or work for the government.
Yeah, and it's a very big step. I mean, I know personally, just thinking through making the decision from being an associate to going into academia, that you know, it's undeniable that finances play a big part of it. But it's also a matter of ultimately of what you derive the most pleasure from and what you get the most satisfaction from. And it doesn't mean, frankly, and there are are people I knew who derived the most satisfaction from doing what they were doing as associates, and that's great. The public interest.
Maybe they weren't deriving the satisfaction from doing what they're doing. Maybe it's from getting what they were getting.
Or getting what they were getting. Although
they're
I have
prepared
to
make a trade-off.
Yeah. Although I have to say though, I mean, I did know associates who enjoyed the steps in litigation that many people decry. I even knew someone who I think genuinely enjoyed going through boxes of documents or discovery, which blew my mind because that certainly wasn't an activity that I enjoyed and most of the people I knew, but to each their own. But it does lead to a follow-up question with respect to students today. I'm from the generation that I guess was called Generation X of sorts. I guess the late 80s, the people graduated from high school in the late 80s and what have you, and this generation goes with Generation Y, and people have various silly monikers with respect to what you call this generation. The point being, there's genuinely, and always it seems to be that people say that the current generation isn't interested in public interest lawyering, whatever that generation is. Now, perhaps the 60s, a large portion of the 60s might be an exception to that. But in talking to students about this book, and indeed in the reaction you've gotten to the book thus far, what's your sense of the mood of the average, if you will, law student of today with respect to public interest lawyering?
Well, it's very hard to do a non-scientific survey.
Of course,
even here at Stanford. I do know that...
I'll treat it as anecdata.
Anecdata. Yeah, yeah. The plural of anecdata that is data.
Right. Yeah.
Or if I say it, it's evidence. If you say it, it's an anecdote.
Right.
The first year class, and I may have the numbers slightly wrong, had an opportunity here at Stanford to do voluntary pro bono work. No credit, no money, no nothing, just do it. And more than half the class signed up to do it. That's an incredibly encouraging sign, because I think that when many students do it and see what's happening and what they can do, even if they go to work for law firms, they will kindle this spark, and it will make them say to the firms, we need to set aside some time, or I need to set aside some time, and the firm ought to do it too. Mm-hmm. And so that's a very important first step. Second is, I think a lot more people would go into nonprofit or government work if there were jobs and if they're not necessarily the same. The pay were a little better.
Yeah.
But one way to deal with that is through loan forgiveness, and Stanford, among other law schools, is starting to get pretty good programs. And it's one thing to live off your salary. It's another thing to have to pay down substantial debt. And we're talking $100,000 in debt for many students here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very big nut to crack when you're making $35,000 or $40,000 a year. Can't really do it.
Which I guess, we only have a minute or two left, but the financial aspect of legal education is another, I think, major issue. I mean, the fact that depending on the school, you're looking at tuitions, that go well into the $30,000, dollar range today. And that creates, many perverse incentives, among them being simply that you can't afford to do it. What role do you think legal education broadly, or law schools in particular, have in encouraging public interest lawyering beyond suggesting that it's a good career? Do you think that there's a role there? Do you think that there's things that law schools should be doing that perhaps they're not?
Well, I certainly think that the loan forgiveness programs are directed in the right way.
Mm-hmm.
That it doesn't do good to give money to people up front. Because your ability to predict who's going to work for profitable organizations, who's going to work for nonprofits, it's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you can do it, but it's risky. And if you give if the person turns out to be able to do that, then you give it to them at the other end.
Yeah.
The programs are getting better all the time. They're being more generous, and they're covering a wider range and for longer periods of time and more types of organizations. So that's a really important positive step. There are just other things that are too difficult to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
Many nonprofit organizations, indeed many even government organizations, don't know whether they're going to have any vacancies at the time that the recruiting season starts in the fall.
Yeah.
And, the recruiters come around and they have nice parties and they invite you to go on airplanes to their cities and they wine and dine you there. And it's very tempting when you're leaving the life as a student.
Yeah.
But the law school here is trying to educate people and get them to think more broadly beyond the next couple of years. And, of course, the final thing is, and this is partially where the book comes in, is you are not eternally damned or doomed or destined if you go to a big firm for a couple of years, pay off your debts, make a little money, learn a little something, and then go on to do something else. Many of the lawyers in our book started that way and went on and did something else. That's the way I got started, and, of course, mm-hmm. it was a different time. But the point remains that you're not locked in, which is one of the great things about the legal profession here in the United States and many other countries. You start in, and when your first job is your job, and you're there, and that's the track you're on. Mm-hmm. Not so here in the United States.
I guess we'll close with this closing question, but the title of the book itself, how did you choose that title at the end of the day?
Well, we started with Beyond the Traditional Law Firm, and the publisher thought better of it and said Beyond the Big Law Firm. We said, that works better. And so the Big Law Firm has a meaning, I think, to most people, certainly most lawyers.
Right.
And so that's how we went with that title.
Well, Alan, I want to thank you for being here today. I mean, as you know, the litigation model that you said is something which I'm personally interested in, and I appreciated being able to chat with you over the last 2 years from time to time about public interest litigation, having the benefit of being a fellow at CIS. So not only thank you for being on Hearsay Culture, but thank you for affording me that time and giving the benefit of your wisdom. And so thanks for being here.
You're quite welcome, and pass some of it on to your new students.
That is my goal, to be a teacher that encourages people not only to think about public interest litigation generally, but also think about the kind of lawyers that they want to be and how the profession can contribute positively to society. So thank you for being here today.
My pleasure.
I want to thank Alan Morrison again for being on Hearsay Culture. As always, you can find this show a number of ways if you're not listening live on KZSU. You can go to hearsayculture.com and find the show as well as the schedule, and also find my email address, dave@hearsayculture.com, for anyone that wants to offer me feedback. Additionally, you can always find the show by going to the podcast page for CIS at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. There's an RSS feed there. And finally, on the iTunes page for CIS, by typing Center for Internet and Society into the podcast search engine on iTunes. So thank you very much for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more of its diverse programming, and I look forward to talking to you next week. Have a great day.